Okay, we said we were going to talk about organization at home, but we got to plug in. Vulcanization, self-vulcanization. This is Robin Kelly, whom I found on the internet. This is her hair before, nice and straight, and it's held straight because the protein chains are linked together by sulfur-sulfur bonds, so that ties them together and holds them in shape. It's like vulcanized. Okay, bridges complete polymer chain. But that's not the shape she wanted, right? So she reduced the disulfide crosslinks with excess basic thiol. So you can use one of these two thiols typically, right? And notice that those things have pKa about 11, which means that you can easily have RS minus, right? Much more acidic than water. Okay, so now you can, what reaction do you think is going to happen? How are you going to break that sulfur-sulfur bond if she doesn't want between her proteins? Do an SN2, right? So now you've broken that, but you can react that with another thiol. But now you have the same thing you had before, so it can pack another disulfide linkage there, for example, and make that one into SH. And now that can attack another sulfide linkage down below, and again and again. So now the hair is much more pliable, right? Because it's not cross-linked, it's not vulcanized anymore. Yeah.
Where do those the sulfurs come from?
This that she puts on her hair.
Oh, I see.
So you take one of these compounds, and notice it's an exchange. You started with a disulfide here and a thiol here, and you end with a thiol here and a disulfide of this stuff. Right. So just by putting enough of it on, you get rid of all the cross-linking. Okay. And now what does she do? Yeah. Pardon me? Oh yeah, because one of your amino acids in a protein is cysteine that has SH, and those get oxidized to make sulfur-sulfur bonds. So it's like vulcanization. Okay, now what does she want to do next? The hair is now pliable. Is that what she wants? Her hair just pops down? She wants it to be curly, right? So she curls it, right? Like that. Okay. And now what do you do to keep it curly? Vulcanize it again, but in this shape. So the sulfurs that are near one another in the shape you want make new cross links. So remember that these are the bond dissociation energies involved, and the sulfur-sulfur is a rather weak one. So it's much more favorable if you have peroxide and thiol to change to make alcohol, a very strong bond, and the disulfide, which is a rather weak bond, right? So you go from 139 downhill by 30 kilocalories per mole. So she just puts a little bit of a peroxide on, makes that one back, makes that one back, makes the other back, right? And now the hair will stay in the shape that she curled it in by vulcanizing it. Yeah. They don't call it vulcanizing.
Which step is exactly vulcanization?
Cross-linking. Vulcanization is what Goodyear did by putting sulfur with natural rubber to make sulfur crosslinks between the polymer chains. So this makes sulfur crosslinks between the proteins of the hair chain. So it's just like vulcanization, but you don't call it that. You don't do it in tire or bear. Now, there are lots of synthetic rubbers that can have, for example, there's a class that has easily made and broken crosslinks. So, for example, the things that are on the chains can be something that's ionic. And then together with the counter ion of that pair, they can get together with other ions and hold one another by ionic attraction. So that makes a crosslink too. But that's much more easily broken, covalent bonds. So if you warm it, you can make it come apart, reform it, then cool it again, and it'll come back together, and you have your new set of crosslinks. So there's some malleable crosslinks. This is Julius Newland at Notre Dame University. At the time, he invented a new polymer called neoprene, which is very like natural rubber. Remember, natural rubber is isoprene. It has a methyl group here. He took one that had a chlorine group there and polymerized it with free radicals to make a different one of chloroprene that was more resistant to oils. So in fact, you can compare natural rubber with a whole bunch of different synthetic rubbers, many of these are made by free radical polymerization, and some by Ziegler-Natta polymerization. The polymers in general use, I mean, the big polymers are, of course, cellulose made by your friend nature, right, and yourself, right? But among synthetic polymers, about 40 or 45% are made, in fact, a little more than that, are made by Ziegler-Natta polymerization that we talked about. And of the rest, somewhat more than half are made by free radical polymerization. And the others are made by making bonds in other ways, more standard ways than we talked about soon. But anyhow, you can compare natural rubber with all these different, there's neoprene, for example. But an interesting thing is with respect to strength and abrasion resistance and resilience, natural rubber is better than any of these others. So it still is a very important component of tires. There's a real romance that has to do with rubber that we don't have time to talk about how it became the big bonanza of the 19th century when people invented bicycles and motor cars, how it went out with leaf blight in South America, but some seeds had been stolen and taken to Kew in London to the garden and then to Southeast Asia, and they planted new plantations that they take great care to have no communication with South America so the leaf blight won't get to the plantations. So that's a really interesting story, but that's not for today. So radical polymerization, it's interesting to look at the regiochemistry in polystyrene. So you have radical come in, styrene, 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 and keep adding to the double bonds, and you get a long chain, and I've shown it here as if it were random. The phenyls are one place to another along the chain, not regularly placed. An alternative would be to be regioregular, right? Everyone is head to tail. Which way do you think it happens? Randomly or selectively? Can you see any reason why it might be? I'll tell you, it's selective. It's the top one. Can you see why? Why would it always prefer, when a double bond comes in, to add to this end and leave this end as the radical? Yeah.
Secondary angles and
it's not only secondary, it's also benzylic. It's next to the benzene ring with its low lumos that will stabilize it too. So this is 13 kilocalories, that's resonance stabilization, more stable than this one. So it also 13 kilocalories is a big factor, 10 to the 3/4 of that is a big factor. So it always adds so that phenyl is stabilizing the radical. So you get phenyl on every other carbon, and that's true of many polymers. Now this is stereo regularity as opposed to regioregularity. When you polymerize propylene, you could imagine getting, we mentioned this already, you could imagine it being isotactic or syndiotactic. Here, every one of the configurations is the same. Here, the ones marked in red are different with the methyl back. Right? Or it could be atactic. Notice isotactic are all the same. Syndiotactic, every one is front and back, then back, front, back. Atactic is random. Right? And atactic is what you get with radical. You always get head to tail for the kind of reason we talked about before. And here what Mike said is true. This is just secondary, not penicillin. But still, it's enough bias that it's always head to tail. But it's not controlled as to its stereochemistry. But as we said before, Ziegler-Natta polymerization gives stereoregular. So the chains are much more regular in their shape and can pack together better and give a stronger fiber. Okay. Here's a really neat example. Copolymerization, right? So you tune the properties of the polymer by using two different monomers to make it. Now you can imagine these going together in several ways. One possibility is what's called block copolymer, where you have a run of one and then a run of the other. Right, so then you have both properties in there. Okay, and that can be done by just adding one monomer until it's used up, then adding the other monomer, or other tricks like that. But a more interesting way is to have it be strictly alternating, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. Now, how does that happen? If you look at the rate at which a radical attacks either of these, notice if it attacks this one, it gets that benzylic radical, which we saw was stabilized by 13 kilocalories. If it attacks this one, it's a little bit stabilized by the carbonyl double bond, but not so much stabilized. So which one should it attack if you believe in Hammond? It should attack the one on the right. The radical should attack here faster than here. So if we look at the rate, we expect this to be faster than this. And in fact, it's true. It's twice as fast to attack styrene as to attack methacrylate if the radical doing the attacking is this one. Now, would that lead to alternating A, B, A, B, A, B? No, because each one that would appear would prefer to attack styrene. Now, you could control how much styrene. How could you control? Suppose you wanted to get it. Maybe it'll be random, but at least get it 50-50, not mostly styrene. Is there a way you could do that? Pretty obvious. Yeah. Increase the concentration of the other ones and make it as reactive, taking the concentration into account, as styrene. But what's interesting is this one. If the radical that's doing the reacting is styrene, then it's twice as reactive with this one as with this one. So now it'll go A, B, A, B, A, B if you have the right concentrations. Everybody see that? You see the fact that it will be A, B, A, B, but this must certainly be puzzling. Why this radical prefers to attack this one, whereas this radical prefers to attack that one. And you can understand that. Here. So you start with a radical, say the styrol radical, and it's going to attack this. Okay? So, there we go. Okay, so it's about 20 kilocalories per mole exothermic to convert the double bond into a single bond, and we get the same kind of radical again, and it looks something like that, has a certain activation energy. Now, if that styrol radical instead attacks this double bond, convert it to that, it's not as exothermic. That radical is not as stable as that radical is, not as stabilized. So it's not as far downhill. What do you expect for the rate? If you're Hammond, you expect it to be slower. But in fact, it's a little bit faster. So the Hammond postulate is breaking down here. The one that's more exothermic is slower. Why can we understand that? Here's the transition state. So there must be something operating at the transition state that's not operating at the product. So you don't expect the transition state to be a mirror of what's happening in the product. So there's the transition state for attacking styrene, and there's the transition state for attacking methyl acrylate. Now, what could be the difference between these that makes this one unusually stable? There's the first attack, and there's the second one. Right? But this one can be stabilized by having plus here and minus here, because this minus is especially stabilized by having the low LUMO next door. So if you like resonance structures, you can say this one has a favorable resonance structure that this one doesn't have, but it only has it at the transition state. Once this becomes a full bond, you don't have a resonance structure like that anymore. So this is special stabilization in the transition state due to that kind of resonance. Okay? So you could say ionic resonance structure stabilizes the transition state. But I never like to say that because that's not something that's fundamental, you know, why something really is. What really is true is the carbon-oxygen double bond gives an unusually low LUMO that's good when the SOMO is not too low. Okay? So that's a better way, I think, of explaining this. And it applies only in the transition state, not in the product. Well, that's enough to say about radical polymerization for what we have time for. Now we'll go on to acetylenes and other cases where you have more than just a double bond. And we'll see that some of that first here in chapter 10. This I'm just going to flip through real fast because we've already talked about it. But I had it laid out here clearly, so in your study it may be helpful to have this. So one hexyne adds HBr, but it's 100 to 1,000 times slower than the ionic addition to an alkene, so that triple bond is not so reactive because the vinyl cation intermediate is not so great. And we see here how much worse the vinyl cation is. Okay. But this can be isolated in 40% yield, and this is what we talked about before. So HBr can add again to the bromoalkene, but obviously more slowly if you can isolate this stuff. Right? You have a second Markovnikov. So why is it Markovnikov orientation? And this, remember, we talked about, that bromine has two effects, or chlorine for that matter, as a substituent. It's both electron withdrawing in the sigma system and electron donating in the pi system. So that was just for review, so you have that there. Now, section 10.8 and to 10.11 is about other additions to alkynes. We go through it rapidly because it's pretty much like alkenes, although it's a little bit less reactive, as you say. But the addition can be Markovnikov or anti-Markovnikov. The initial product of adding water, hydration, is H on one and OH on the other. It's an alcohol, right? But it's a special alcohol if you're adding to a triple bond because it has a double bond on the carbon that has the alcohol. That makes it an enol, which undergoes acid-catalyzed isomerization. And the reason it does so is because the C double bond, though, is so much more stable than a C double bond C. So converting the enol to a ketone is favorable. Now, I just say that rapidly in summary, but I'll show you the parts from the book that reinforce that, and you can look at it on your own. Okay, so here's using mercuric ion as a catalyst to add water. We talked about that in the case of an alkene. In this case, we got, in the alkene case, we got HG here, OH here, was a single bond, and removing the HG required reducing borohydride, you may remember. You should remember, at least by a week from today. Okay, but in this case, you don't need that. Just acid will do it and take it off again. So you get this enol. So you add an H and OH, where H replaced the mercury. And that's very like in the case of addition to alkene. But the difference is that the enol can be protonated with an acid here to give a stabilized cation, resonance stabilized here, which could be deprotonated to give the much more stable ketone, C double bond O rather than C double bond C. So that's what we're talking about. So that's something special in hydration of an alkyne, that you actually get a carbonyl group. Okay? Remember, you could also do BH3 to react with double bonds. Here it reacts twice with this rather hindered alkene. The third one doesn't react so well because it's very hindered. So this one, this then gives a borohydride that's rather hindered. So it's able to attack an alkyne to give this. And remember, the B and the H will be on the same side in hydroboration. We talked about that. So that, can you guess why you use this rather than just using BH3 on the acetylene itself? What would be the disadvantage of diffusing BH3 on the acetylene? Why have the middleman? What might happen to this product? Madeline? It could react again, but it won't in this case because this thing is so crowded. Remember, it couldn't react with itself again. It can react once with an alkyne, but not with the product of the alkyne that's in here. Okay, so that way you can stop at this stage. And then how would you change that into an alcohol? An R-boron compound. Remember what else you do after hydroboration, Don?
Hydrogen peroxide
will then convert into the alcohol. So here you keep with hydrogen peroxide, get the enol, but as before, the enol will isomerize to give, in this case, an aldehyde. Okay. So here's a specific example of this reacting to give an aldehyde. Because there was a hydrogen on this carbon, does it surprise you that when this added, it added where the hydrogen was, not where the R was? So the OH will be where the hydrogen was, and it will, like this, where the hydrogen is, so that when it'll give an aldehyde with H there rather than a ketone. Notice this could have, you might imagine this reacting the other way, where H goes here and B goes here. But you remember the B vacant orbital adds first to the less substituted center. So you get the less substituted alcohol in this case, whereas with the mercury you got the more substituted alcohol. So this is an example then of having control over the reaction. If you use mercury and water, you get a ketone from this acetylene. But if you use the same acetylene and use the hydroboration and oxidation, you get the aldehyde. So you have regio selection. You can control which one you get from the same starting material. There's also the possibility of having stereo selection in reactions with alkynes. If you do catalytic hydrogenation of the alkyne, the two H's come in from the same side. That's what we said happens in a double bond as well. Of course, you'd worry that you have a double bond that would react again. And that's where this special catalyst comes in with lead that deactivates the surface. So it's just enough to react with the acetylene, but not enough to react with the alkene. And as you can imagine, that was just discovered by fiddling around. Okay, but anyhow, it's able to do that and get 96% yield of the cis alkene. Okay? But on the other hand, if you do the addition of hydrogen in a different way, reduction by sodium in ammonia, then notice you get the opposite. You get 98% in this particular case, trans addition of the two hydrogens. So in this case, you had regio selection, which end the OH adds to. Here you're adding H to both ends, but you're controlling the stereo chemistry. And you get either product you want, depending on what reagent you choose to do. Now, how is it? We understand already how the catalyst makes it be cis. How does this thing make it be trans? Okay. So what does sodium and ammonia do? Sodium actually gives up an electron. It doesn't give it to a particular molecule. The electron is just there in solution, but it's surrounded by ammonia molecules that make it stable enough to come off sodium. Okay. So what you have is a solvated electron. And the solutions are blue. That's the color of the electron. Okay. Now, if you take that reagent, which is obviously a very high HOMO, it's hardly even an orbital, right? The electron's hardly in any orbital at all, right? It'll attack pi star here to give a species that has an extra electron. So it's both a radical and an ion. And now, so you can write it with a radical on one carbon and the extra electron from the original double bond or triple bond on the other. So it's a radical anion. But of course, a carbon anion is a strong base and can take a proton away from ammonia. Okay? So now you get an H on there, but this is in an sp squared orbital, but it can flip back and forth. From here to here. That is, the methyl group can move back and forth. Right? Which of these two do you think would be more stable? Can you think of a reason that would favor one of these over the other? Yeah? Right. In this case, the methyls run into one another. Right? So this is the more stable one. And now you have this product. Now, so that's adding. Notice we're going to add an electron and then a proton. And then another electron, and then another proton. It happens in stages. Okay, so now we have this, which is mostly in this form, right, as the arrow show. And it's going to pick up another electron into this very low LUMO, right, to make the anion. But once it's an anion, it can't flip back and forth as easily. This is like what we did with XH3 before. If you put an extra electron in there, It remains like pyramidal, right? Although it's not, it's only two-dimensional, not three-dimensional. But anyhow, it doesn't flip back, so it traps the fact that the methyl is here. And now when it gets another proton to give the product, it gives these two groups opposite one another. So when you use the metal catalysis, you get the two hydrogens on the same side of the double bond. But when you add electron, proton, they come in on opposite sides.
Could trap it with the other configuration?
You could, but it's mostly in this form. So that's the way it mostly reacts. Okay. So remember, it was what, some 96% or something like that, very strongly in that direction. Okay, you can read about that in the book. I don't want to do that quickly. Now, alkyne acidity and isomerization, and a little bit of this is a review too. When we showed this scale of pKa values before, remember water, ammonia, carbon, and we said they were approximate of why they were the way they are. And then we pointed out that a vinyl CH bond is more acidic than a normal alkane, and acetylene is ever so much more acidic. And we talked about hybridization as the explanation of that. And now we have part to read in the book that relates to that. And now these things that have more, where it's the CH is adjacent, a carbon adjacent to the triple bond, and where you have two double bonds in a row, that's called acumulene, when you have double bonds in a row, not separated by a single bond. Remember, when they're separated by a single bond, their p orbitals could be parallel and interact with one another. When they're attached to a common carbon, the p orbitals are orthogonal to one another, so it's a very different situation. Okay, but anyhow, those have pKa's just a little bit higher, that is, they're a little bit less acidic than ammonia is, but this one is more acidic than ammonia, and that will come into play, as you'll see here. Okay, and there's the stabilization in that case. Okay, now, here are the energies of these isomeric compounds. Four carbons, a triple bond, two double bonds on a common carbon, that's acumulene, alene in this particular case, and the triple bond at the other end of the, at the end of the carbon chain. And they have these energies, and if you plug those in with 10 to the 3/4 delta H, you find that essentially everything is here. At equilibrium, there's 0.1% of this, 0.03% of that. Okay. Now, that's fine, unless what you want to have is this. Suppose you wanted to make that. Well, can you interconvert these things? Not that it's going to help if the equilibrium is on this side, but at least it's a start. Okay, so we can interconvert them by pulling a proton off here and putting it on here. Then you'd have this. Or pull a proton off here and put it on here, and then you have that. So we can imagine using a base to get among the two. So we can have, so this has the dissociation as an acid. There's the for this one, and there's the anion we'd have at the end. Right? The pKa's are, the pKa of this one is 38, as we said. So Ka is that. So we can get what the energy is. It's 51 kilocalories higher than this. So we can, and this one is 33 kilocalories higher than this. So that allows us to put these two bars on to what the energies are at the anion. Right? And this one we're just sort of guessing based on the acidity of that thing. Okay, so there, here would be our reaction path to get from left to right or from right to left by pulling off and putting on protons. Now, how does that look as a practical method to make the conversion? In the first place, you're not going to go uphill at equilibrium, but how about how fast it would be?
Very slow.
Right, okay. So 10 to the 13th times 10 to the minus 38 says it would be, the half time would be 10 to the 17 years. That's about 10 to the 4th times the amount of time since the Big Bang. So don't hold your breath on that one. Okay? Now, what could you do about it? If you put in hydroxide, that'll make, it'll snarf up the proton, right? And that's worth about 21 kilocalories. Okay? So that's going to lower all these. So if we put an actual base in, then they'll come down like that. And now we'd have this, right? Now the half-life would be 30 years at room temperature. That's a lot better than 10 to the 4th times since the Big Bang. And what could you do to make it faster? Heat it up. If you run it at 150, then it's 2 minutes for the half-life. So if you heated it up with hydroxide at 150, then you'd get back and forth, but you still wouldn't get what you wanted. Now, suppose instead of that you put in a strong base, sodium amide, which favors dissociation, that is, which snarfs up the proton at 45 kilocalories, right? So now it's going to lower it even more. And look at this one. Now that's the lowest energy. When this one could be an anion if you have a strong enough base, when the others are not. Okay? So now you see the trick, how you're going to do this, how you're going to make this stuff is what you want. You put in this very strong base, right? Because at equilibrium, in the presence of that amide, it's an anion, there's only 0.001% of this. Everything is over here. Okay? So here's the trick. You equilibrate with the strong base to form the terminal anion, and then you quench it by rapidly adding water, which will donate a proton to the terminal anion to give the acetylene you want. But at the same time, it'll protonate the bases, so now it'll be, you'll stay in that form until 10 to the 4th times the amount of time since the Big Bang that you've made it. So that's a neat trick, to shift the equilibrium by a trick like this, and then quench it and get it in that form. Or you could add H+, and then get it out. Okay. Now, the next two chapters, 12 and 13, are about conjugation, in case when you have double bonds reacting with one another. So conjugated pi system. And here's an example. Now, the word conjugated is interesting. It comes from the word for yoke, like oxen. Yoke from yungere, from this Indo-European word, which means to join. So these two double bonds, when they're conjugated, are joined together. You could say that the cumulene, when they're attached to a common carbon, are joined together, but they're really independent because they're orthogonal. Whereas in this case, when they're conjugated, they interact with one another, so they have special properties. Okay, now, this is really interesting because most of what we've talked about since last semester, we've analyzed in terms of localized orbitals, single bonds, double bonds, unshared pairs, things like that. So pairwise MOs and isolated atomic orbitals. That was our intermediate between hydrogen-like atomic orbitals, as you'll remember from last semester, and the orbitals, that the complicated MOs that a computer generates. When do we have to think more deeply than that? It's when things are conjugated. So when does conjugation make a difference? Does it always make a difference? So here's some evidence that has to do with that. For example, you can imagine that the single bond here could be cis or trans, so it could rotate. Now, notice that when it's halfway rotated here, these two are orthogonal to one another. There's no overlap between this one double bond and the other double bond. They're independent double bonds the way they would be in here, right? So how high is that barrier? That tells you how much it's worth to have the two double bonds conjugated with one another. And it turns out that the barrier, it doesn't say here someplace, it's about, now the height of the barrier is 4 to 5 kilocalories per mole. So the conjugation is worth about 4 kilocalories per mole. Twisting a double bond, where you really break the pi-pi interaction, costs 60 kilocalories per mole. So this is a much lower order of interaction than that between two p orbils. That doesn't surprise you, I think. Or we could look at it from the point of view of the heat that's given, of the stability of isomeric compounds. For example, 1-pentyne and 2-pentyne here. The 2-pentyne, the one with the triple bond inside, as we just saw in the isomerization stuff, is more stable. It's more stable by about 4 kilocalories per mole. And, whoops, I wanted to do that. And in this case, when you have these two cumulative double bonds, the alley, they could be terminal or it could be internal. And again, the difference is a few kilocalories per mole. Right? That's because this stuff we've talked about a zillion times about using the sp squared carbon hybrids to bond to carbon rather than to bond to hydrogen. Okay, so you like to have these triple or double bonds internally. So that's a couple of 2-3 kilocalories, 4 kilocalories per mole. But in the case here, where it can be conjugated or not conjugated, that's a bigger change. That's worth about 5 kilocalories per mole. Right. So it's not very big, but it's bigger than this other thing we'll talk about. Okay. Or in this case, the conjugation is worth something a little less than 7 kilocalories per mole, because part of this is due to the same effect we saw here and here. So anyhow, 5-6 kilocalories per mole is what you have for conjugation. Remember, that's the same thing we saw for this barrier to rotation. It was about 5 kilocalories per mole. So conjugation of the ion is worth something like that. There's another way to measure it, which is to see how much heat is given off when you get rid of a double bond. So all these double bonds give off 30 kilocalories per mole when you put H2 on them, catalytic hydrogenation. Okay? These that are, when they're not conjugated and you have two double bonds, it's twice that big. That's what you expect, two independent double bonds. Okay? But if you have conjugated double bonds, then it's about 4 kilocalories less that you get out, because it was more stable to begin with. So again, we're seeing the same number, 4 or 5 kilocalories per mole is the stabilization due to conjugation for carbon-carbon double bonds. But allylic stabilization is bigger. If you look at the cations, and you may, by breaking this off, make a plus here. So now you have a conjugated cation. That's a lot more stable than the unconjugated one. The gas phase isn't such a great place to look for it because of the internal solvation thing we've talked about. But you see that it's as good as having the cation be secondary, right? If we look at anions, we see here that a regular alcohol and an alcohol that's allylic differ by 6 pK units, 6 powers of 10. So that's about 8 kilocalories per mole. Even more when it's a lower LUMO over here. Or if you have an allylic radical. Remember what allylic is 3p orbitals in a row. If we look at these bond dissociation energies before and see that conjugation here is worth 13 kilocalories per mole. So that's sort of a standard number to talk about, 13 kilocalories per mole, a lot more than the 5 you get when you just have two double bonds together. So why is conjugation worth so much more in allylic systems, 3p orbitals in a row, than it is in the dyene, 4p orbitals in a row? Many people would say it's because we can draw more reasonable residue structures in the case of the allylic system. So in an allylic system, these two resonance structures are equivalent. So the rule is to say that's good. And the resonance structure you draw here, which has charge separation, you say is bad. So you say resonance is important here, it's not here, therefore this is stable. So that's a fine mnemonic device for remembering which when one, or recognizing which ones will be more stable if you can draw these resonance structures. But molecules never draw resonance structures. That's not why they're more stable or why they're stabilized, right? To see why, we have to look a little bit at what orbitals are involved. Okay, so conjugation and aromaticity are what's involved here, and they're by far best understood in terms of orbitals. And I actually haven't tried this recently, but it may still work. It allows you to make simple Hubble molecular orbitals of pi systems, so that might be fun to try sometime. Now, let's just think about the conjugation in butadiene, the two double bonds. We can analyze it in two ways. We can say we put 4p orbitals in a row and see what molecular orbitals we get out of it. That's the way a computer would approach the problem. Or we could say we have two double bonds and let them interact with one another. Okay. So let's first start with just taking 4p orbitals and putting them together. So we have the lowest orbital, the next one, the next one, the next one. And of course, the lowest one has no nodes, one node, two nodes, three nodes. That comes as no surprise. And I think I already mentioned last semester why they have these sort of distorted shapes, not all the same height. Did I talk about that before? It's because this orbital is overlapping twice favorably, whereas this only once. So you get more bang for your buck by putting density here than having it there. Whereas this one is in a good and a bad. This one is only good, so this one is bigger and that one smaller. So, okay, so that's the way a computer would go about doing it. Now, and we put then two pairs of electrons in the double bonds, right? And that would be our energies. Now, if we take a localized pi bond picture, we take two p orbitals and put them together, and we get two pi orbitals, two double bonds, and two pi star vacant orbitals. And pairs of electrons would go into the two pi orbitals, the two double bonds, yeah. Yeah. The trade-off is making the low orbitals as good as possible requires making the bad orbitals as bad as possible. So the ones below the line you make as good as possible, the ones above you make as bad as possible. It's a very good point, I should say. Pointing that out. So now, how different are these two pictures in what they predict for the overall stability? Okay. If we added and subtracted these two to get the ones that aren't distorted, right, but are the same size here all along, okay, then two go down, two go up, right, and the sum that we get for two here and two here is, to a first approximation, the same as where it started. So the conjugation didn't make any difference. It would be slightly unfavorable for the reasons we've talked about before. But to a first approximation, the conjugation didn't count for anything in this case. Yeah. Oh, we want the orbitals for 4p orbitals in a row, right? What we're going to do is take this one, which is pi and pi star, this one, pi and pi star, and we're going to allow those two, we know what they'd be when they're isolated. They'd be here, those energies, two here and two here. And now we're going to let them interact by mixing this together to give the four in a row, the four in a row. And we see that the overall energy is about the same as where we started. So conjugation wasn't worth anything, taking this into account, you know, isolating. Okay. However, and of course this doesn't make any difference because there are no electrons there. But if we mix this with this, this LUMO with this HOMO, they reinforce in the middle and cancel a little bit at the ends. They don't mix very much because the energy match is so poor. But if you put a little bit of this in with this, then you'll get something that's a little lower in energy for exactly the same reason it is here. In fact, this is the same as that. That's the same energy. And if we take this one and mix it with that one, apart from that, that's the other one, but it's vacant, we don't care. And it's this mixing is minor because it's a poor energy matter. And if we mix the other one, we get this and this. And this one, notice, if we mix this with this, they cancel in the middle, reinforce at the end, it gets a little bit more stable. So instead of having the electrons and the energy we showed here, they should both be a little bit lower. And that's the conjugation stabilization. But it's very minor, right? It's only worth three or four kilocalories per mole, right? It's not a big deal. Okay, so conjugation isn't worth much in butadiene. Now, you might say, why not mix these two with one another? There the energy match is better, and there we might get something out of it. Can you see why those two don't mix? Henry? They're orthogonal to one another. There's no overlap, no net overlap between these two, because it doesn't lower the energy, because what you would gain on one end, you lose on the other end, okay, if you try to mix those two. Okay, but there are substantial differences in HOMO and LUMO energies, not in the overall energy of the molecule. But in the reactivity, there'll be difference. Because there you care what really is the energy of the HOMO and LUMO. And if you didn't have interaction, this would be your HOMO and this would be your LUMO, right? Or if you wanted to absorb light by taking an electron from here and putting it there, you'd need high energy light. But if it's conjugated here, then you need less energy light. And so this will be more reactive than isolated double bonds are. So even though the overall energy wasn't very different, the individual orbital energies, therefore the reactivity, therefore the spectrum, is different. And we'll talk about that spectrum, which is mentioned in this chapter, a little more in about a week and a half when we get on to spectroscopy. Okay. Now, is there a limit to the energy in the long chain? And I'm going to go through this quickly now. So here's the chain length of two. And each atomic orbital here has a size 1 over the square root of 2. So when you square, you get half in each. Sum of the 2 is 1. That's the whole electron. Okay? And the overlap per pi bond, 1 pi bond, is the product of how big this is and how big that is. It's a half. The overlap, remember, is the product of the two. The number of pi bonds is 1, and the total overlap stabilization is a half. Okay. Now, if you have 4 in a row, each of them is 1 over the square root of 4, or a half. The overlap is 1 quarter for each, because they're smaller. But there are 3 bonds, so the total stabilization is 3 times a fourth, 3 fourths. If you have 8 of them, it's 7/8. You notice the stabilization is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Does it just keep growing without limit? No. Because if you have n, it's 1 over the square root of n, 1 over n, n minus 1. So n minus n over 1, or approximately 1, is the limit. So yes, there is a limit. It's about twice the stabilization that you have here. The electrons here are stabilized by a half Here, they're stabilized by 1. So next time, we're going to go into seeing how other orbitals change when you make the chain longer and longer. I forgot this last click. Similarly, the LUMO destabilization is twice. The LUMO has plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. So it's just a mirror image of this. So it goes to 11 too. And next time we're going to talk about what happens to the orbitals in between them.